reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam. In the last few days, actually the last few weeks, we have been in the morning Bhagavatam discussing about Prahlad Maharaj and Hiranyakashipu and the appearance of Lord Narasingadev. And particularly in the last few days, we have been discussing about the Prahlad Maharaj's teachings in regard to the mind and the need for controlling the mind as a prerequisite for devotional service. So we will take up yesterday's verse and continue in the same line. Jayasuram bhavamimam tvamai atmana samam manodhaisvana santi vidvasa ritejitadatmana utpate stithat tadhiyantasya mahat samarhanam. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Translation. Prahlad Maharaj continued, "My dear father, please give up your demoniac mentality. Do not discriminate in your heart between enemies and friends. Make your mind equipoised toward everyone. Except for the uncontrolled and misguided mind, there is no enemy within this world. When one sees everyone on the platform of equality, one then comes to the position of worshipping the Lord perfectly." Purport. Unless one is able to fix the mind at the lotus feet of the Lord, the mind is impossible to control. As Arjun says in Bhagavad Gita 6.34, "Chanchalam hi mana Krishna pramathi balavad dridam tasyaham nigraham manye vayor eva sudushkaram." For the mind is restless, turbulent, obstinate, and very strong, O Krishna. And to subdue it, it seems to me, is more difficult than controlling the wind. The only bona fide process for controlling the mind is to fix the mind by service to the Lord. We create enemies and friends according to the dictation of the mind. But actually, there are no enemies and friends. Pandita Samadarshina Sama Sarveshu Bhuteshu Mad Bhaktim Labhate Param. To understand this is the preliminary condition for entering into the kingdom of devotional service. Om Ajnanta Mirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Melitam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha. Hare Krishna. So Prahlad Maharaj, at the age of 5, as we all know the story of in the Satya Yuga, how he has been tormented by his enormously powerful father, Hiranyakashipu. We need to understand the position of Hiranyakashipu first, that it is not like any ordinary power or even a great power that we can conceive in this world. The kind of powers that Hiranyakashipu had were ruling over not only the entire universe here, but all the demigods also were petrified. They were so fearful of him. And there was nobody who could stand in front of him. And here was a 5-year-old boy, his own son, who was the ideal son from all respects, even from his point, even from Hiranyakashipu's point of view. A son who was very loving, very sweet, very respectful, very wonderful natured. The only thing is that he loved Krishna. And because this really was it was an insult, really, to Hiranyakashipu that his son could actually worship his own enemy. So it is in this condition, when he is being threatened by his father, the enormously powerful Hiranyakashipu, when this little boy is able to explain to his father and tells him that, my dear father, please give up your demoniac mentality. Do not discriminate in your heart between enemies and friends. Make your mind equipoised towards everyone. Except for the uncontrolled and misguided mind, there is no enemy within this world. When one sees everyone on the platform of equality, one then comes to the position of worshipping the Lord perfectly. So, we see from the instructions that Prahlad Maharaj is able to give to his father, the astonishing thing which he brings forth here is that there are no enemies and there are no friends. That is news to us. It's not something which we would be used to hearing. Or maybe we might think that this is in some different yuga, because today we say, this is my friend, this is my close friend, this is my acquaintance. And at the same time, we also, if we don't say it, at least we do feel that this is my ill-wisher, this is, and certainly this is my enemy. The enemy may have many faces. He could be your landlord, he could be your wife or husband, could be your boss, it could be so many different aspects. Could be a rival, people whom you don't like and whom you are convinced that people do not like you. And we look at a discrimination in our eyes between those who are for us, those who are against us, then those who are in our team, those who are against us. This is the nature of the mind. And it is something which we are used to. We accept Krishna consciousness, or we accept devotional service, we accept chanting of the holy name, we accept the process, we come to the temple, we listen to lectures. At the same time, we do not feel generally that this aspect of enemies and friends needs to change. That we can live with that. We can have enemies, we can have friends, they will always be. And we carry on with our life and we progress. Actually, that is the way we start. We start with, in our own life, with in whichever way Krishna gives his mercy, brings us eventually to a spiritual master. Some devotee will take us onward to further steps. So we start that way. But as we go along, this for us, all of us, this is a very crucial aspect which, if we don't recognize it, could be an obstacle for progress in spiritual life. And that is basically because, you know, the mind really captures our senses, and the way we look at from the eyes of the mind, the way the mind directs the senses will be the actions that will emanate from us. Our activities will be guided by our senses. And we may even stop the gross activities on the bodily platform. Let's say when we come in contact with devotees, we then start following four regulative principles, hopefully. But even then, we may feel that that is enough, that we do not need to go beyond that. But we miss out the more difficult challenges which are on the subtle level. And that is really where these aspects, where the mind dictates to us, which makes us act on so many ways. And this is the way we see also the way the world around us looks at. Because the entire, the way the world is functioning over the last several centuries, we are born, and from the time we are born, continuously we are given the impression that we are this mind. This is really the way we think, the way we act according to our own thoughts, and how we can appreciate other people's mind, how we can act on our, on the way our mind dictates. If the mind says that this is the way I should go, we will go. So we are taught, we are completely covered by this aspect of this major thought that we are this mind. And therefore, we do not know the difference that actually the soul is captured by the workings of the mind. And therefore, the false ego really becomes very prominent. And why is this? Because our senses really are in flames, wanting to progress the way we are told that what is progress. Now you take every aspect of society, every aspect of our activities in the world, and we will see that eventually it leads to tragic consequences, because the senses will actually go like wild horses. You know, they'll pull us in various directions. The way the new thinking develops, the way the new thoughts that come in the world, what is considered progress? Take any aspect, even those aspects which are considered so-called progressive. We take, for instance, health. Today we are told that there is, naturally everybody wants to improve their health. So the technology is the most important. You know, billions of dollars, thousands of crores of rupees are spent in research only to improve and prolong our health. So our mind is going after this, that yes, those who are working towards this are the gods of today, because they will have the answers for tomorrow. They will be able to lengthen our life. They will eventually someday make us immortal. That is what the atheists think. And there are many, many millions of people who actually believe, and particularly those who are in the higher levels of intellect or society, the so-called intelligentsia, large numbers of those are very strongly atheistic. That means they don't believe that there is another power. They believe that they believe in the power of chemicals, they believe in the power of their own mind, they believe that that can find all the answers. They believe that we are the masters of our destiny. We have the control and we can solve our own problems. So if you take health, for instance, it makes us believe that we are constantly told that the death rate has come down, and eventually we will, someday in the future, we will be able to solve the problem and we may be able to tackle death. So actually the death rate, everybody has to die. We can even a person who is not so-called literate from the worldly point of view would be able to understand. Even somebody, a simple-minded person, can who's just observing, sees that there is nobody who has remained alive beyond a certain point of time. So you can prolong it, maybe add another 10, 20 years over the last 100 years. That's what has happened. But that also is questionable what the quality of life is. But eventually, it is just a matter of pushing it back. So, the way the mind is pushing us is to think that this is the answers will lie in science only. So that means science, which is a very useful tool, becomes the governing power rather than being governed by the pure intellect or pure mind. So it is really reverse role, that actually it can control us. Not only that, even the progress of health, I mean, the kind of research, there are, you know, thousands of crores of rupees that go into research. If you go to the research labs, they have to, how many millions of animals have to be killed or tortured only because they make progress. And slowly the heart becomes hardened. It is a matter of just saying that, well, the ends justify the means. We need to improve the society and life the way we see it, because they don't accept any other rules. The mind sets its own rules. The mind has its own criteria. So it says this is necessary, so it doesn't matter whether it's monkeys, guinea pigs, rabbits, mice, whatever. There are several stories which have come, but then they get squelched from the newspapers, because of the powers of the people who control it. So this is one aspect, and this is supposed to be one of the most welcome aspects. So we are all for improving our health, but nobody will tell us what it is to prevent bad health. For instance, how many people will say that we should eat the right things, we should try to reduce our stress, or we should be having regular exercise. Nobody spends so much time on that. It is always on, why? Because it is profitable for people to keep taking medicines, etc. That is one aspect of it. If you take the aspect that today people want to improve their standard of life, right? Everybody in this world, basically every living entity, has broadly two goals. One is to be happy, and the other is to avoid distress. The two are very, very strongly felt. Every person, no matter what situation, which country, which body it has, even an insect would also want to avoid distress. You try to come in the path of even a caterpillar or a fly or a butterfly, and they will immediately move away out of fright. What to speak of birds and animals, and they can experience fear. So we can see that avoiding distress and wanting happiness according to our consciousness is very, very strongly felt, and that's the way we want to progress. But if the mind is not purified and not guided, then it will go according to the present masters. The ones who have, we see here in Satya Yuga, there was a Hiranyakashipu who was the dominant force, who was in control of the entire universe and all the demigods, all the planets. Everybody was under him. Nobody could say anything. And everybody had to bow down to him. Today, there may not be one Hiranyakashipu, but there are many, many, perhaps most of us would be tiny Hiranyakashipus or tiny Ravans in a very, very tiny form. And we're tiny not because we'd want to remain tiny, but because we don't have the capacity. So if you match the desire, perhaps we'll be nearer him. But unfortunately, we don't have the capacity. And why is the comparison like that? Because eventually the nature is the same. The nature is, why is it demoniac? Demoniac, again, we've always been thinking that demons means, as we've seen perhaps in movies and all, we have big teeth and, you know, big ears and black and all that. It is actually one way of giving us a wrong impression. That means we think that when we see a mirror and we say, we are not like that. And so we are completely all right. We are actually the good people. Actually, demons means those who do not accept the supremacy of the Lord. Full stop. That's it. Now, you go by, and if we say we believe in the supremacy of the Lord, then every aspect of our life needs to be compared by what the rules set by the Lord are, according to his scriptures, according to different religious faiths also, the bona fide religious faiths, all say the same thing. So if we live by that, then if the mind is guided by that, where selflessness is more important than selfishness, where cooperation and seeing other people's happiness, consideration for others becomes more important than what is for me or my extended family. It could be my family, it could be my community, it could be my nation. Ultimately, it is selfishness. Because the minute we say me, then it is always versus someone else. Even today, what to speak of, if you take the example of even religion, today if you see how the mind has completely twisted the whole aspect, take the last 100 years, all the religious faiths and the leaders, it is so difficult to find. There would be, of course, there will be some genuine saints. There would be some, but generally they would not be in the limelight in terms of, you know, newspapers and won't be prominent. But those who claim to be the leaders of the various religious faiths, and see whether they actually follow the faith that of whether it is Jesus Christ or Lord Krishna or Prophet Muhammad, whether they're actually following that. But you'll see that, in fact, they are propagating, the leaders, they're propagating totally different things. The so-called the leaders of the Christian faith, for instance, all over the world, they're so fundamentalist. They say that anyone who does not believe in Christianity will go to hell. Practically every single major faith will say that. There are very few exceptions. Now, how can you accept that you will only this will be the leaders? In the Hindu faith, the no less, the so-called people who are leading the Hindu faith, I mean, they They become Hindus only when they're opposing someone, when they are actually standing up rather than following what the Vedas and the scriptures tell us, how to actually internalize Vaishnav qualities. It is actually expressing a faith, means how can someone deny me my right and I have to fight someone. So it may be one narrow aspect, but that becomes the governing principle. So that means they want to dictate the way the faith is to be seen in the world. Take the Muslim faith. There is no shortage of fanatics who will say that everyone else has to be thrown into the sea. And even in the Jews. So you can take today, in other words, because the mind has insisted and taken us to levels of following our senses. Now senses could be gross senses, which means what I should eat, what I should drink, what I should enjoy, what I should see, feel, touch. That's one. But even on subtle levels, the way I understand religion, the way I understand health, the way I understand every aspect of my life will be dictated by this approach. It's a paradox of life. There are more and more varieties of food, but there's less nutrition. So we can see that actually you may have people are concentrating only on what they can, because it is seen from a profit-making point of view, from an industrial point of view. So basically the selfishness which becomes the manifestation of the false ego, where the false ego is actually saying that what is in it for me, what makes me happy, and that's fine. Anything else is to be rejected. And a classic case of this kind of selfishness, you've seen the recent papers, the last few weeks, most of the headlines practically have been about this one particular case of abortion in Bombay. And there are close to 40 million abortions in a year. That means 4 crore children are killed in the wombs primarily because they are not needed or not wanted. So we are quick to say that if some child walks in and we take out a gun and shoot the child, this clearly we will say this is the most horrendous thing. It's unthinkable. And we have to put the person behind bars. He should be hanged and the whole public will be behind him. He'll probably be lynched before he even reaches the police station. But when it is unseen, it is unprotected, when it is defenseless, it doesn't have a external face to it, it is convenient, but it is inconvenient to the parents, or to the, it may not even be parents, it may just be somebody who's just had, most of the cases, it happens because of their sexual so-called liberation, and they have, just been having so many different partners, and and now it is just by accident they've had a child they don't want. Or perhaps it's a sex of the child using technology that this is now a boy and I don't want it, or this is a girl and I don't want it. So whatever it is, they want to get it removed. And they will not even call it a child in abortion. They call it tissue, that we have to remove the tissue. It is because there is, and there will be all kinds of arguments given as to, they'll obfuscate complicate the whole issue about deliberately saying when the life starts and when it happens. Anybody, there are enough proofs, there are not just by religious bodies, but even scientific bodies who have said, clearly shown when life starts in the womb. And therefore, clearly, here this is one case where because it is inconvenient, there is a removal of the child. Now, this particular case which took the headlines, became kind of so public because in this case the Indian law actually allows abortion, which is this is called Bharatvarsh, but we allow abortion if the child is less than 20 weeks. So they have stepped in and made a law that if it's less than 5 months old, you can remove it because we can't, for whatever reasons, they have said that 20 weeks is a demarcation level. Beyond 20 weeks, unless it is threatening the life of the mother. In this case, the child is 26 weeks old, which is almost 7 months. 7 months, there are children, there are many deliveries that take place in 7 months, and the children are healthy. So here is it was almost 7 months old, and because through technology they came to know that the child is likely to have some heart problems when it is born, will have to have a pacemaker, will have a block in the arteries, and these are probabilities. There is no certainty, but this is the feeling. So the parents the mother and the father decided they want to move it, even though it is almost 7 months old, because the argument is that the child will be so much inconvenienced and so much handicapped, and it will be put to so much difficulties when it grows up. Not to say that their own quality of life is affected. The point really is that my quality of life, so even if it's my own child, the sacred relation of a mother and child, you can see how the mind is actually kind of gives us the impression that for my benefit now, even if it comes to my own child, because it is going to be a difficulty, a headache, a problem, my quality of life will suffer, we should get it removed. And as it was, as luck would have it, quite a few organizations stepped forward before this came in the court and said that we will adopt it and we will take care of the child. So even then they said, no, why should we give someone else the burden? So that means they want to say that we want to kill the child, but we don't want to give it to anyone else. This is an instance, of course, the court ruled against it. The court has said so far that that is not allowed. But since it's a recent case and it is in Mumbai, of course, here is a case where somebody went to court, it became public. But if they had not gone to court and gone and done it, who would have known? So it is only it's a symptom of how the mind is working. So let's not assume that it is just one case in a very rare issue. It is symptomatic of the way the mind works. That slowly it is coming to the need to see what is in me. That self-preservation instinct is actually taking us more towards the animals rather than, so as Prabhupada said, that we are actually two-legged animals if we do not follow the laws of God. We can see this here, that actually the animalistic tendency is so strong that we want to really go on instinct. The animal at least has no intelligence, and therefore the animal goes only by instinct. Human being has an intelligence, and the intelligence is supposed to control the mind. But here in this case, we see, in such cases, we see that where it can go astray. And then that leads to quarrels, because if you're looking for your own self, and if you're looking for your own family, you're looking for your own community, and you see this innumerable cases. I mean, it is by the dozens every day. It could be in your own cooperative society, it could be on the road, it could be in the bus, it could be in the office, it could be in your own house. We see these quarrels happening more and more. The smallest, slightest provocation, and it just flares up. We see it on the streets also. People come to blows. I mean, those who are perhaps now in their 50s and 60s, if you look back, I think 20, 30 years ago, though we were in Kali Yuga, it was much less. But you can see that now it is quite amazing to see that the slightest bit, and not only it flares up, but you have 100 people who have nothing else to do and they are now watching. Everybody is watching. So it is really a question of, because they identify with it. They also have gone through it. They also feel that everybody wants to take a side. Who's correct and who's wrong? We all want to play the role of God in every aspect. We want to be the judge. We would not want to see it from the eyes of Shastra. And then what really takes prominence is, in such cases, would be very by token or symbolism. That, for instance, because the average Indian, at least, most Indians, particularly those who are in the smaller towns and villages, they have strong roots of the culture still, which are weakening, but they still have it. So they are at least, because they have the large numbers in votes. So you will see the leaders, whether it's the business leaders, the politicians, the ones who need the votes from these people, from time to time they will make a gesture, they will make a public display of going on a You know, if it's Ganesh Chaturthi, they'll go to Siddhi Vinayak and the photos will be showing that, or they will go to Vaishno Devi, or they'll go here, or they'll go there to show, gives the impression that, oh, this leader is also very religious. It doesn't matter what they eat, what they think, what they pretend to be, or what they are. It is more just that this is, so it is the tokenism, it is symbolism, it is by gestures. It is really to give us a feeling that, you know, I have done my duty, I give an impression of what it is. So the reality becomes secondary. The importance is the perception. If your perception is that, yes, I am very religious, then it helps you to feel that, oh, my religious sentiments are also protected. So it is, so in the word of secularism, what it means is throw out God out of the picture. Secularism actually means that you have to have tolerance for all faith. But that happens only, that is the second step. The first step is you must have faith. If you don't have faith, where is the question? So today the secularism is based on no faith in reality. Externally there may be, you know, you may have several temples or you may have several mosques, several people may be wearing that clothes. But in the spirit, because the spirit has to be how people live their lives, how people cooperate. They talk of equality. See, the mind, it tells us that, yes, we must have equality, but we have laws for that. We have to have job quotas for it. But today, do you really, there is discrimination at all levels. When it comes to, you know, we still go by caste in the way we act. And if you don't go by caste, in the Western countries, they have a different caste system. They go by economic strength. If you, even for, between countries and countries, America and or the Europe, European countries, because of their power, they look at the other countries as poor. They look at them as backward. The word used is, if you, you know, regularly used in commerce or management or economic studies, constantly you read, and even the newspapers, that we need to, there are the developed countries, they're called the first world countries. And then there are the third world countries, which are the backward countries, the agrarian or the rural economies. Now, what does it mean that these are poor, they are unfortunate, they are backward, they are duffers, they are low, and they have to progress. So they are low and this is high. The second world, of course, used to be the communist bloc, but that is, you know, now most of them are gone out of the window. So this is the third world and the first world only. You don't hear about the second world. So basically, slowly, slowly, when things are mentioning over and over and over again, gradually this becomes the impression in our minds that, yes, the what I need to, we are backward, we need to do it, and what those people have done is the only way. That is the only way, it doesn't matter. Now, because the rules are made by people who are in establishment, in control of events, therefore, they dictate the way all the laws are made, the way the economic order has to be mentioned. It does not, the people who don't have, what do they do? Today, if a law helps 100 million people in India, what about the remaining 900 million people? They don't have a voice, because democracy has split everyone, means it is only each one to himself. It's like a divide and rule. At the time of vote, each person is really kind of brainwashed into thinking that this person could help and you please give the vote. And collectively, that party will settle for ruling. But then the rules are, if you talk of the party which is ruling, whichever party, where do we see the sacrifice? Where do we see the selflessness of the leaders? Where do we see that people really feel compassion when they see the suffering, they want to do something? If people don't have water, if they don't have basic amenities, has that been a priority? So even on a, leave aside spiritual path, even on economic path, it won't work unless people really understand what true equality means. And if we see only from the eyes of God that everybody is born equal, no matter what the backgrounds, then we can start understanding how we get a glimpse of how the world order could be in Satya Yuga. For instance, in this room, there are perhaps in the three rooms combined, we have 1,000 people here. We don't even stop for a second to think which caste, community, which background, which state, which language, which educational level. It doesn't matter at all. When we're having kirtan, everybody's together. What does it matter? Whether somebody has 100 crores or 100 rupees, it doesn't matter at all. This is what Prabhupada really established as the real United Nations. This is what he meant by bringing on the level of the spirit soul. And he had the courage to actually to put it against all the criticism. See his commitment to his to the parampara and to the spiritual master. That he, against all odds, as we know his story, that he with heart attacks and strokes, and he was all alone, poverty, absolutely no help. He went there and he wanted to establish what, and he knew that it was seen from the eyes of the Shastras, in this giving the change of consciousness. Here is a case where the mind ultimately is in Krishna can control all the minds. All the minds are in Krishna's hand. So if you see it, if you please Krishna and take his help, he will help us to purify intelligence. And through his mercy, the intelligence will control the mind. And we can see that then the kind of policies that emanate, the equality, the genuineness of relations, mistakes will be made because we are all imperfect. He was pure, but we are not pure. But there is, we can see in a very small way that how the world order could be established if the mind is given proper directions. And if you extend this to not just a small, in our family or to the community, but if you see how it works in the world at large, so many wars and so many difficulties, so many tragedies that take place, then we get an idea of where this, we are talking about enemy and friend. We're talking of enemy means what? That is hatred, right? You hate someone, then you feel that so and so is your enemy. Oh, we may not actually perceive it today, but if you get an idea, because we have the mind, we have a very small understanding of the world around us. But if you get an idea of just from the events that happened, take any one war. Any one war, what happens? I mean, there are thousands of people who die. And if you know one person who is dead, you know, we may be knowing of stories when somebody, maybe a cousin of ours, or maybe in our own family, some relative or in the village or community has died, how much it affects us. Now, if you multiply it by few thousands of times, and not just in India, but it could be another place, it could be in Iraq, it could be Afghanistan, it could be Sudan, it could be Kashmir, it could be Palestine and Israel, so many places. So this is just one way to see how much tragedies there is and what happens when there is killing. In killing means there is a tremendous amount of agony and resentment and pain. So when that happens, then you start seeing that this person, they will see naturally from the person, from the relation. Say a person who's killed, who's shot dead, He may be, let's say, a terrorist also. What do you think the terrorist family will think? Do they think he's a terrorist? They will think the world is a terrorist. They will think the US is a terrorist or whoever is against them. It is natural. So you will see in all these wars, you are seeing so much of hatred. And we are now talking of literally tens of millions of people affected if you take across the world. So you can see just by one action, that is war. What to speak of non-violent problems? How many disputes there are, how many fights there are, how many law, there are something like 350,000 or some, I forget the number, of pending backlog of cases in the court. Now when a legal case goes, what is a legal case? When there's a dispute, some may be business disputes, some may be personal disputes, etc. Maybe with your landlord or it could be just between families. So that is just a symbol of what discontentment takes place. A legal case is a symptom of dispute. When dispute is there, then they are not the best of friends, obviously. And if you're talking of a backlog, which is 20 years old in India, and it is increasing. Increasing means, and so that is it's a measure of what the status of happiness could be. So you can again see that these are just pointers towards seeing that across the board that there is a huge amount of inner resentment, sadness, which overcomes us, or bewilderment. And therefore, when we see from the eyes of the Shastra, that how we can try to lead our life to bring it to peace. And then as Prabhupada always quotes in Bhagavad Gita, the real peace formula is when we see everybody when we see Krishna supremacy and everybody being part and parcel of Krishna. Now, if you compare this situation today and see some of the examples that we have seen in Shastras and by the Lord Himself, for instance, in the Ramayana, now Lord Ram, he was the heir apparent after Dasharatha, and he was the most beloved of every person in Ayodhya, and every person who came in contact with him just could not bear to live without him. Forget about just appreciating from a distance. They couldn't even bear. Can you imagine a whole country or a whole nation actually feeling that they can't live without the ruler? Today we can't even think of one person in our life like that. What to speak of here, the whole nation thinking like this. So in such a case, he had so much popularity, such love because of who he was. And then when Kaikeyi spelt out her curses and wanted him to be banished for 14 years, there was a huge uproar, not only from Dasharatha himself, but also from everyone who came to know. And easily, if Lord Ram wanted, you know, everybody would have been very happy if he had, and Dasharatha himself said, okay, I'm taking you out of the obligation. I mean, you don't have to worry about it. And the brothers wanted to, you know, take up swords and so on. But Lord Ram could have chosen the path of accepting everybody's verdict, saying that I want to fulfill, but everybody wants me to stay, so I'm staying. But here was a case where, against every argument, he insisted and he went ahead and actually went to the forest. And the rest is history, as they say. And of course, it is really to demonstrate to us the very point that what real leadership is. So the Lord himself came to show of what real selflessness is, that to protect the honor of his father in the true Kshatriya spirit, he went to the, he accepted the banishment. Same is with Maharaj Amrish, who was again the emperor of the entire universe. And then Durvasa Muni, because who was a very, very powerful sage, who had enormous Shakti, who could also read the minds of the other people. But because he came with 60,000 of his guests, and as is the custom, the king would have to feed all of them. So it was time to break the fast, and deliberately Durvasa Muni and said, we all will have a bath and come. And they took long time before returning. So all the Brahmins and the Pandits who were there, they advised Maharaj Amrish that actually the time for breaking the fast is going soon. So, you know, you'll have to, otherwise there will be inauspiciousness, not just for you, but for the entire, all the subjects. So it was a very difficult situation. So then he took just a drop of Chalnamrit to break the fast so that it could satisfy the auspiciousness part. And at the same time, it was not exactly like breaking a fast, just a drop. But Durvasa Muni, because of his powers, he understood. And then the kind of anger he displayed, the words he used, he was so upset. And then he unleashed a demon whom he tried to use to destroy Amrish Maharaj. But actually, because of Amrish Maharaj's purity, he was totally unaffected. And we understand that how Durvasa Muni finally was in a position who he was completely helpless. And then, you know, he ran from pillar to post, he went to Brahma, he went to Shiva, and finally he came to, and they said, no, well, you know, he went to Lord Vishnu, because everybody said, well, you better go to Lord Vishnu only. Even Lord Vishnu said, I'm also helpless, I can't do anything, because you offended my devotee, so unless he forgives you, I can't do anything. And then he goes to Amrish Maharaj. Now, see Amrish Maharaj's consciousness. A person who has reached the level of material success, opulence, and the control he had, of all, which we cannot even fathom, even if we want to. We can't understand what it is, because we don't even have a smallest kind of comparison today. But nevertheless, even if we were to try to multiply it many, many times, that's the kind of power, prestige, and control that he had. And yet he never felt it was for himself. He was so much entirely in a Krishna-conscious mood everything was for the Lord, and he was only seeing himself as an instrument. So when Durvasa Muni came to ask forgiveness, he immediately gave it. He didn't give any explanation, didn't even chastise, nothing. And even in the beginning, in fact, when Durvasa Muni came back from the river and he said, you broke the fast, etc., he accused him, Amrish Maharaj did not even try to justify himself. So actually, this is a wonderful lesson for all of us, that there's a subtle point where, sometimes we may be right about something, and we want the world to know that we are right. And, we may be wronged by someone is doing something wrong, and we are actually in the right in that particular instance, and we are so keen to explain to someone, justify, and say that, no, you see the point, this person has done this, and this person has done that, he's in the wrong, please see it that way. And that tendency, the urge to justify is very strong in us. I know a few times when with His Holiness Radhanath Maharaj, when I would actually try to justify it, and some issues would be there earlier on, and I could make out that he would never say anything, but I got the sense over time that he never liked this attitude or this to bring out. Even though you can be technically right and say that yes, you were right in this instance, but then we forget that there are so many times that we were wrong and nobody knew about it, and we kept quiet about it. So actually, we don't have a sense of our own fairness. And therefore, when we see from the tendency of the Lord or His devotees, and by their behavior and try to bring it into our lives, then, we can be guided. So we should never trust our mind. Better to trust Krishna's mind as is revealed through His pure devotees. Many examples, even in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Shivas Thakur, and there was this Gopal Chappal who wanted to humiliate, or wanted to spread wrong information and humiliate him. And Shivas Thakur did not try to justify it at all. And he said, yes, I am. He tried to also agree and say that, yes, even though he was completely blameless. So, these are the words, these are the actions of how a great personality would, or a pure devotee would actually act, wherein they're seeing, they don't see any need for prestige for themselves. And what happens then is, because when there is a constant bombardment of this kind of feelings within us, eventually when you have a crisis or some major issues come up, and when you have to act in a certain way, whatever is most prominent in our lifestyle or in our thoughts will actually come through. And again, you see quite a few instances like this. When it is on a larger scale, in the U.S. a few years ago, there were some huge floods in New Orleans. This Hurricane Katrina had come, and it caused huge destruction, and there was devastation, because water was there for something like 10-15 days before it receded. So there was complete chaos. The electricity had gone off and so on. And in that those periods, there was large-scale looting. Now here we are saying a country which is so rich, so prosperous, and people who generally have, if you don't have a job also, you get at least $1,000 or $700-$800 a month, even if you don't have a job. Every person is guaranteed that. Unemployment dole, as they call it. So there would not be any poverty the way it is constitutionalized. Even then, when a tendency, the urge comes, people will just, if you get a freebie, as they say, you get something free when nobody's seeing, nobody's watching, they just wanted to go and grab it. So it's a sign then, and it's on a collective level, by the thousands. And there was complete lawlessness at that time, because when so much water is there, they couldn't do anything. Even here in Gujarat, a few years ago when they had, the riots took place, 4-5 years ago, in the aftermath of the riots, the cities, particularly the larger cities, there were complete chaos, because of curfew, and there was a lot of fear and so on. And there were reports, so many reports, that actually people used to drive in their cars, were coming in the cars, they would break the shop windows and take the entire refrigerators, put it in the car, and then they would phone their friends in the mobile and say, come here, come there. So it is a tendency of the mind, and it happened by the dozens. Come and actually take, took entire, so the need, the greed is so strong that if the mind justifies everything, say, well, you know, who cares, it doesn't matter, it's for me. In many years ago, only once it happened in Las Vegas. You know, if you may not have heard about Las Vegas, a city which is famous in the U.S. because it is kind of the capital of gambling in the world. And everything, the whole city is only designed for that. They have some billion-dollar hotels and the great shows and everything just to attract people to come there. And then and there are flights which go take thousands of people every day straight there only for that, and after a few days they take them back. So even the flights are very cheap because they know that you will lose enough money to justify coming there. It's a fact. Even the hotel rates are very cheap because I remember when we had gone there many years ago, I mean, it was less than half of what you would pay elsewhere because they know that it doesn't matter. They don't earn from the income from the hotel and what you eat and all that. It's mostly by, and if you see the casinos, again, it's something which is beyond your imagination. If you have seen a football field, the size, the open size of the main hall, which they call the reception, when you enter a hotel and, you know, you have a check-in and there's a somebody who takes you in, you know, the bell captain and so on, the luggage helpers, they're usually there, there, and then there's a big hall. Here, this would be the size of 9-10 football fields, one full area, and it's all filled by thousands of various machines, gambling machines, slot machines, tables, and so on. Now, in that scenario, and of course, they have all the provisions to see that everything works well. Just many years ago, it happened once, and it's quite hilarious in a way, but it was also very sad, that just for a few seconds, the whole city's power went off. And here were people who come there. Generally, you see, most of them are very well-dressed. I mean, obviously, those who have money, they come there. And when you go there, you don't normally just pay with your money on the table. You have to go there to the windows, which are all lined at the side, and you get chips. Suppose you want to play $1,000. You pay $1,000, then you get chips of $1,000. And the chips are like these small coins, something like your carom coins, and the different denominations, 5, 10, 15, 100, whatever. So, you know, this much could be, $100,000 could be only this pile, you know, depending on the chips you've taken. So it's more sophisticated. You know, you don't have to take out money and put money like that. You know? That you see, that happens here. Here means you might see in the C-grade movies. But what actually they do, they all go and play in chips. So everyone's very kind of sophisticated in their bow ties and suit and everything, and they're sitting around the tables. And then even they're all gloved. Even the people who are dealing out the cards, shuffling. It's done very, very smoothly. It's very stylish. You know, they all wear gloves, the ones who are dealing out. No? And then the way they take the coins and the slot machines and then the roulette machines, everything goes very smoothly. And then for a few seconds, the power went off. And just for a few seconds, hardly 5 seconds, 10 seconds. And when the lights came back, literally almost everybody was sprawled on the tables. They were all sprawled. They were all trying to grab the coins and take it to the... And the lights came. It was so embarrassing for them because they were like all cheats. They would be the first to say, somebody comes to my house and he robs, put him in jail. But here everybody was doing that, thinking he will not be caught. So they were sprawled on the table, literally, and they didn't know the light would come so fast. Each one was trying to take the coins, and they got exposed. I mean, so this is the, what happens is that when there is a tendency, when we live a life according to certain rules which are completely atheistic, and then an occasion may come, a crisis may come, a demand may come in our life, what will happen is we will act according to those dictates. We'll go by the dictates of... and then we will be justifying it and thinking that that is the only way. Take the case of Hitler. Adolf Hitler, everybody knows, the most infamous man in the last 200 years. He started the World War II. But if you studied history and you go back to the 19... just after First World War when Germany lost, and then the 20s, 30s, why did he become so popular? Has anyone stopped to think that how could he lead a nation which conquered virtually the whole world and took 6 years for him to be stopped? And it was not that he went alone and shot with a pistol. He actually garnered a whole country And many countries joined him. If you hear his speeches, and if you, you know, I have heard his speeches because I used to study German, so I, you know, that was one of the ways there was, and I can tell you, it is really hair-raising. An enormously talented person, the way he would speak, mesmerizing, absolutely mesmerizing. To talk of how people, you know, the politicians, some of them have got a gift of the gab, they speak very nicely. So he had that. Secondly, you know, he was talking of nationalism. He never talked, oh, this person is like that. You know, he never, the way we see it now, he affected everybody by saying that on German nationalism. Because they were humiliated in World War I, the country was humiliated, and he actually roused them and brought them to a high level where people really justified it. They said, yes, it's national spirit. We have to protect it. And the Aryan race is most predominant, and the Jews are the worst. They should be killed. And it is necessary. It is they're criminals. They're this, they're that. They can justify anything. And then 6 million Jews were killed in World War II. So we can now we are looking 50 years behind. None of us were alive at that time. So, you know, it is in black and white and seen that, yes, obviously he was a criminal of the worst order, etc. But people who were there that time, people, Sachinandan Maharaj, his grandfather was actually part of the Third Reich. Third Reich was the kind of army empire which really ran the military operations. And because he's German by nationality. And so, you know, we can see just two generations ago, people are, some of them are still alive, who have participated. Now, they were not criminals by nature. It's just that they allowed themselves to be aroused into that spirit, which took them to that kind of heights. So we can see that actually if we don't guard ourselves, if we do not get consciousness of the right type, which is actually leading us to what is real peace, how the why the mind should be controlled, how it can be controlled, we can be completely led astray. It's like the example is given in the Bhagavatam about you know, when a hunter, he's going after a prey. Let's say he's going after a leopard, and he traps the leopard. Then if he doesn't pay attention, if he lets the leopard loose, the leopard could actually attack and kill him or kill the people around him. So in the same way, the mind is compared to that leopard where if you trapped him, then it is prudent to see that it is kept trapped. It should not be released. The minute it is released, it could actually attack you. So the mind, if you let it loose, if you completely let it uncontrolled, it could turn back and kill your spiritual inclinations. So that is why once we even have an opportunity, we should make sure that we do something to keep it entrapped. And keeping entrapped means keeping it guided under proper guidance, which is really seeing through the eyes of the Shastra. Also, Sukhdev Maharaj compares the mind to an unchaste wife. An unchaste wife has many paramours, you know, lovers, and then the lovers would actually eventually may plot against killing the husband because the husband is an obstacle. So the mind is like the unchaste wife because it is, what are the paramours or the lovers that the mind is going after? Anger, lust, greed, envy, illusion. And then those would eventually kill our spiritual inclinations or misguide our mind. So therefore, if the mind is not controlled, it completely blocks the vision for any spirituality. Otherwise, just see, we are told that we understand that Krishna is in our heart. Krishna is everywhere. But we cannot see him, we cannot feel him, we cannot touch him, we cannot experience him. So what is blocking us? Simply put, it is only the accumulated dirt in our minds which is actually keeping that cover. And because it is acting as a, keeping us away from seeing or experiencing Krishna. There's a very nice example also given in the Bhagavatam about the need for controlling the mind. And the example is of the lantern. If you have a lamp, a lantern, in the lantern, the most important thing is the wick, which you have to light and which gives the illumination, the light. Now, if you control the wick, then the light is proper. But if you don't control it properly, then it, in fact, it could, the inside of the whole lantern becomes black. And when it becomes black, then in fact it obscures the light itself. So you can't even see the light, even though the flame is there, but it has actually become fully black. So in the same way, if the wick is compared to the mind is compared to the wick. So if we control the mind, then it is said that, you know, and if the wick is actually controlled, then it is in touch with the ghee. And the ghee actually gives the effect for the illumination. So here, His Holiness Radhanath Maharaj is explaining that if we keep the wick, the mind constant or controlled, then the ghee is compared to the Harinam, the Hari Seva, Hari Katha, where you know, it is the feeding ground for the mind to be controlled. These are the approaches that how the mind could be controlled if it is kept together. So, since Krishna is the controller of all controllers, I mean, we saw that, you know, he is in control of all the minds. Therefore, if we go to the root and if we appeal to Krishna, then he, in fact, helps to, out of his mercy, he would allow us to come to him. See, the Maya energy is also his illusory energy. So it is Krishna's energy. It is totally subordinate to Krishna. Krishna could always, if he wanted, to say that, you know, stop affecting this person or this individual. And Maya would instantly stop. But actually, Krishna tells Maya that this person is not yet a pure devotee. And in order to purify him, you know, you or her, you you know, can harass him a bit, cause these problems, do this, do that. Because in that difficulty, he will look towards me, he will start chanting the holy name, and then I will come to his rescue. So actually we see that it is Krishna who creates the situation whereby we can come to him. And that is the way in the lives of the great souls. That is why we see in Queen Kunti's prayers, Queen Kunti's life was an incredible life of difficulties. Though she was a princess, and then she grew up to... even in her childhood, you know, she had children from the demigods, and she had to abandon one child. And then when her husband died at a very young age, and she had to live on for the sake of the five children. And then we know that so much affluence, and they were living in the in the castles and everything. And then they had to actually abandon everything. And had to run away to the forest. Not only go there, but after they lost the gambling match, but they were humiliated. And not only humiliated, but they were being killed. Attempts were made to kill them. So you can imagine the kind of fear and anxiety and all that they may have gone through. But after all that came the Mahabharata at the end of the 13th year. And in that we know that at the end of the Mahabharata in 18 days, 64 million people were killed. And only 5 people... practically, all the 5 sons of hers were alive, and a few others only. And all those, and of that, the oldest Yudhishthir was anointed the king. He was the emperor of the whole world. So this is a situation where Queen Kunti is in, when her son is now coronated as the emperor of the world. Can you imagine what we would be feeling after a lifetime of misery and difficulties and running, and then finally we would feel that at last Krishna is very kind, God is great, and you know, he's looked at, and now all my problems are over, I'm so happy. But she was actually in misery, and that's when she actually said that let the calamities happen again and again, because Krishna, then only I will be seeing you again and again, and seeing you, my Lord, means not having to see repeated birth and death. Can you imagine her prayers at that stage when it's the culmination, the final, just when her son is being coronated? But because Krishna was going back to Dwarka, and she felt, for her, that was the biggest loss. So we cannot understand how a person can say this unless we see, if we try to see, at least on a mental level, that Queen Kunti was a pure devotee, and for her, the need to be present with Krishna was most important in her life, was something which was of closest which gave her the greatest joy, and actually being away from Krishna even for a short time was very, very difficult for her to bear. And then we can understand that what if we are not at that level, then if we follow the path by Krishna's mercy and if we are sincere, we could actually go to the someday come to that level. So actually, if you see that the need, how do we control the mind then? And the control of the mind really, as Prabhupada has said in the purport, Prahlad Maharaj also says, that when one sees everyone on the platform of equality, one then comes to the position of worshipping the Lord perfectly. And what Prabhupada says also, to understand this is the preliminary condition for entering into the kingdom of devotional service. So to see everything on an equal level is very, very difficult. But how Prabhupada made it easy for us, why? Because he engaged everyone in service. And he would say this often, that, you know, an idle mind is a devil's workshop, as the saying goes, that if we don't have enough to do, or if we have too many distractions. So when the mind is occupied with service, with responsibility, you know, with commitment, if you take on commitments, then even if the anxieties are there, that is actually good to have that. Anxieties will come. Even Prabhupada had transcendental anxieties for ISKCON. And the parampara, all the gurus would have also on behalf of Krishna. But it was of their transcendental anxiety is actually ecstasy for them, which we may not be able to understand it. It is not about the personal sadness, joy, and because they are not on that level at all. So what Prabhupada wanted was to give more and more devotees to take more and more responsibility of all types, starting from taking the vows. Or even if you've not taken the vows formally, at least if we take a commitment and start chanting the holy name. So we are constantly told that the most important aspect of our life is chanting the holy names, our rounds, doing it attentively. Japa is most important. So even that, for a sincere devotee, for all of us, you would agree that it is a source of anxiety. And actually that is also, so that is, in fact, that is a sign that that is good. If we are completely oblivious of our distractions, you know, if we are not worried about distractions and happy if the mind keeps wandering when we are chanting and thinking about so many other things and we finished our rounds, and then in fact that is a cause of worry. But actually those anxieties are there even on the level when we are chanting. The anxiety is that how do I bring the mind back? Because the mind is running away and thinking about this, that, and that time only we get all the clarity about all the activities, and then we have to, it doesn't come any other time, only that time it comes. So we are constantly struggling to bring the mind back, constantly hear the words, and so this anxiety is something which is happening on a daily basis, and therefore this anxiety is necessary, and Prabhupada wanted it, because in transcendental anxiety, an anxiety for Krishna consciousness, because Krishna is happy to the extent we are surrendered. Krishna is wanting us to come to him, and this is a sign of surrender, that we are trying to surrender our consciousness to him, to think about him. So starting from japa to so many other activities we may take, following the regulatory principles may not be easy for all, perhaps. Maybe some aspect of conditioning is very strong. That is again something where the effort is what Krishna sees. And then if we even take the regulative principles and the chanting, but then there are other services that we should take up, or we already have. If we don't, then we should take up. There are hundreds and hundreds of opportunities that are there in so many ways, assist directly doing or assisting others who are doing. In all these, trying to do it properly, taking on a commitment is very important, because in that sense, we are forced to think, how can I improve my service, I should not let down the other person. If I am working with someone, he's depending on me. If I'm, how I can please my seniors or my Vaishnavas, friends, or whomever I'm working with, and certainly how do I please my spiritual master, how do I please Srila Prabhupada. These thoughts constantly are necessary, and that is why when occasionally And when the movement expanded, so many devotees were young and inexperienced, and they were in tremendous anxiety. When the Chaitanya Charitamrita was to be published, and Prabhupada said, I wanted it to be done in 2 months, 17 volumes had to be, they had to be edited, and the artwork, everything had to be ready, so much, which would have normally taken at least a year of hard work, had to be done in 2 months. And then the final printing on, and it was an international job, and devotees managed it. How did they do it? It was not their power, it was Krishna's power, but because they accepted the anxiety, they embraced the anxiety on behalf of Krishna. They took it as service to Guru, pleasing the Guru. So we should not avoid this, we should not run away from these anxieties. Sometimes we are overcome by it. I mean, we should see that actually these anxieties are, there will always be anxiety, but Krishna will provide to make sure, and it is His kindness to see that we remain on the straight path. So these kind of anxieties, which are on a spiritual level, are necessary. And within our spiritual level also, when we are balancing between, say, our occupation and our personal life, our spiritual life, that is also an anxiety. How many hours? I mean, now suddenly we are spending up to 2 hours chanting every day, and then you may then adopt some practices at home, may have deity worship or call devotees at home, maybe attending counseling meetings or go satsang programs. All these are suddenly having, which were not there before in your life, and now it has come. So every person will always have this challenge, that how do they manage? They have their occupation or they're working at home. So somewhere or the other, that remains, and there's something else coming on. So this anxiety, but Krishna will, through our intelligence, will give us the idea to see how we can improve our productivity, personal productivity, how we can avoid the wastage of time, how we can do some things faster, how we can minimize things which we were doing earlier which are not so necessary. So we have so many conditionings. So this, if we are sincerely attempting it, Krishna will help us. So all these are signs that, even living in anxiety and sharing it with all the devotees, being together, is actually very comforting. And we know that at the end of the day, it pleases the pure devotee, the pure devotees of the Lord. And if they are pleased, then we only see our life by, that is the only measurement, that are we pleasing the devotees. And the pure devotee is pleased when his devotees and others are, other Vaishnavas are served, and we are able to do our best. So, in conclusion, basically, the 2-3 key points are that we should not trust the mind. The mind is, and the world tells us to trust the mind. And Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj says that we should beat our mind 100 times a day with our slippers. So, we have got two contrasting views. And actually, if you see from the eyes of Shastra, we see that the mind can be purified, but it has to be controlled by proper engagement, proper service. It is in the right association. And we have seen so many examples that of if it is not on the right mold, what havoc and catastrophe it can do. And if it is on the right mold, then how wonderfully it can progressively help others and purify our lives. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Any questions? We can take one or two if there are any. Yes, Gaurhari Prabhu.
Hare Krishna Prabhu. Thank you for a wonderful class. You made this point on taking up anxieties in terms of responsibilities and services. But sometimes while doing the responsibility, the anxiety is very mixed. Sometimes the anxiety is, what will others feel about me? How do I present a good image of myself? At the same time, there may be a tinge of anxiety of service, hopefully. But how do we, because the anxiety which we nurture just for presenting our false ego, etc., that can affect our spiritual activities. How do we?
So whatever the motivation, Just like when we start our first steps in spiritual life, we may be actually, when we are told to start chanting, the chanting will purify our lives. I mean, Prabhupada was asking devotees to chant. People were smoking. They were breaking all the four regulative principles every day. And he said, okay, it doesn't matter. Just take up to chanting. And gradually the habits went. So here also, you know, motivations may be mixed. Motivations may be, you know, for the subtle issues. And definitely, many times we would be wanting to have our own, you know, be popular or you know, seen in a right light, or that becomes a larger motivation. Even then, we should just continue. Because if we continue doing the service, it is a matter of time. Either, you know, your desire of glory and all, if it's that strong, then slowly, then after that is over, and that's a very temporary feeling, your desire to do the service will go away. Or if you continue serving, then gradually that will be purified. So in any case, while we are grappling, see, we will not have a grip on the mind. We will never know. So, and we should not even judge that. Like Arjun couldn't do it. There is no question of us even thinking of it. We are only activity-based. We just follow pleasing, and we see various signs of whether we are pleasing. So even if it is wanting to please them and thinking they look nice, but that will not last long if you continue the service. If you continue the service, eventually over time, you know, it will Krishna will take care. So continuity is very, very important. This morning's class on the same subject, Gaurang Prabhu mentioned that it has to be constant and it has to be regular and constant. It is not something. So therefore, any service we take, japa is our first service, but you may take other services. Regularity and constancy is critical.
Thank you, Prabhu.
So, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.